Bogan, will the recording be available to people after the fact?
Yes. Yeah, okay. We'll put it all on the website.
Great.
So I'm ready if you're ready.
I'm ready.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Washington Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs webinar on identifying and serving victims of human trafficking. My name's Logan. I'm the Child Advocacy Specialist here at WICSAP, and I've had the pleasure of coordinating this webinar with the Washington Anti-Trafficking Response Network. Trainings on pertinent topics such as this are one of the ways in which WICSAP strives to support your work as advocates for sexual assault survivors. For those of you who may be less familiar with the coalition, we are also available to you for any questions or resource needs you may have in your daily work. And before I turn things over to Kathleen, just want to cover the standard logistics for today. Hopefully everyone's hearing the audio okay through your phone line. Please do let us know via chat if you're having any problems with volume or clarity. We will also be using the chat function in the bottom corner of your screen for questions and comments throughout the webinar. Kathleen's going to be responding to these as we go today, and we certainly want this to be as interactive as possible, so don't be shy. You should have received a copy of Kathleen's slides in your reminder email for today's webinar, but in case you missed it, they will also be attached to a follow-up email that confirms your attendance and training hours for today, so be sure to check those spam folders. The webinar recording and materials will be posted on our website under the Trainings and Events tab, so please check back in a week or two to access this. And if you're sharing a computer with a colleague and either didn't register or didn't log into the webinar using your personal link, if you could just send me a quick email with your information so we know who all is on the call today, and that way I can also make sure that everyone receives proof of their training hours. And my email is logan@wicsap.org. And as always, we would definitely appreciate your feedback, so please do take a few minutes to fill out the evaluation at the conclusion of today's presentation. WICSAP is very excited to be collaborating with Warren for today's webinar, as we want to ensure that advocates in Washington State have the information and resources necessary to respond to the needs of all trafficking survivors. Kathleen Morris brings a wealth of direct service and multidisciplinary collaboration experience on this topic, so we feel very lucky to have her here with us. So without further delay, I will let her get started.
Thanks, Logan. We're really excited to be doing a webinar because we feel like we can reach so many more people this way, and I see a lot of the names on there that are familiar names that I've either talked to on the phone or we've worked with directly on different human trafficking cases, so I'm very gratified to see all of you on here. We are always very interested in working with service providers and making sure that you know who we are and we know who you are, and we can all work together to provide the best and largest array of services to the individuals that we all encounter through our work. So thank you so much for being on the call. Bear with me if I have technological issues. It's really my fault, my own fault, because I'm not that great at this kind of stuff. So we will proceed through. And as Logan mentioned, if you have a question that comes up, please use the chat function. We will have a couple of polling questions throughout the presentation just to keep you all engaged and to hear feedback from you as we go. So Logan mentioned the Washington Anti-Trafficking Response Network. We are a program, which is, I work for the lead agency, which is the International Rescue Committee in Seattle, and we are a program that provides direct services to victims of human trafficking here in Washington State. We work with a network of community-based providers across the state. Several are in the Seattle area, but we also have one in Yakima and one in Spokane as well, and I'll talk about who everybody is. We do a lot of community outreach and training, but our very favorite and most important training we do is with service providers and those truly in a position to come into contact with a potential victim of trafficking and either refer that client to us or work with us to best serve that that client. We also, as Logan mentioned, are part of a multidisciplinary response to human trafficking in Washington State, and so we collaborate with local and federal law enforcement agencies through that group, which is called WASH Act, or the Washington Advisory Committee on Trafficking. And we do that for the benefit of the people we serve. I always want to say first and foremost that none of the people we work with are required to report to law enforcement, nor do we report anything to law enforcement without the express permission of the people we're serving, except for when we're required to by law. Just to add that in there. So I never want any of you to be afraid to refer someone to us because the person you're working with is fearful of law enforcement. That is not a requirement of our program, and we do serve people who choose not to work with law enforcement. However, we do maintain relationships with law enforcement so that when a client does want to come forward, they're able to do so in a way that is trusted and safe, and to work with law enforcement agents who are informed around trauma and have really committed to being victim-centered. So I just want to make sure that you all are fully aware of that and that you don't have any worries or concerns in that area. So I told you I'd tell you about the agencies we work with. In Seattle and Western Washington, as I mentioned, the organization I work for is the International Rescue Committee in Seattle. We also work with API Chaya, which is a WICSAP member, and many of you are familiar with their work. They used to be the Asian and Pacific Islander Women and Family Safety Center and Chaya, and now they are API Chaya. They merged together to provide services to the community. They provide services in human trafficking, domestic violence, and sexual assault as well. Refugee Women's Alliance is another one of our partners locally, and I'm sure many of you are also familiar with their work with domestic violence and victim advocacy. Youth Care is another provider in Seattle which serves runaway and homeless youth, and we work with them to provide case management to those populations who are victims of human trafficking. In Central Washington, we work with Comprehensive Mental Health, which is in Yakima. They have a crime victim service center and a victim services program, as well as they provide outreach and education under the WARN program. And similar to that, in Far East Washington, we work with Lutheran Community Services Northwest in Spokane. Again, they have victim services unit and provide victim advocacy as well as, and then they provide outreach and education under the WARN program. So really happy to have these partners. In addition to these partners, we really do work closely with the Office for Crime Victim Advocacy at the state level, and we try to provide a lot of networking with crime victim service centers across the state to support victims of trafficking and provide training and technical assistance on these cases. And that's why I'm sure part of the reason I've worked with many of you. We also work closely with WICSAP, WISCATIV, and WICVA, just in order to reach as many service providers as possible. So this is an overview of what we're going to cover today. I am going to go through some basic definitions around human trafficking. And really, I want you to know that what we're presenting to you is really something that's informed by the experience we've had serving victims and survivors here in Washington State. So I want you to know that this is a really specific information and experience that we share with you. But, of course, there are some general pieces of information as well. So the Trafficking Victims Protection Act is the federal law that we basically were created under in a way. It created funding for response to human trafficking. So there are other programs around the country similar to WARN, which are funded through the federal government and because of this law that was enacted in 2000. The goals of the law were to increase prosecution of human traffickers in the U.S. and to protect victims. And really, this is the law that we use to provide the protections that exist at the federal level for victims of human trafficking. A tremendous number of the cases we've worked on have been handled at the federal level. That's how we work. So a lot of the information I'll provide you around the services that we provide are because of federal funding and using federal benefits, but that doesn't mean that we can't tap into them at the state level. I do think it's important to note that Washington State was the first state in the U.S. to pass a law criminalizing human trafficking, and that was passed in 2003. It mirrored the federal law to a great extent, but it's also been improved and added to at the state level throughout the years. There have been a couple of trafficking or a few trafficking cases that have been handled at the state level, and that most of those have been focused on sex trafficking of juveniles, and they've happened in King County. There may be other trafficking-related cases that are happening in other counties around the state, but I don't have a specific list of them. So it's great that we have both the Trafficking Victims Protection Act as well as the state law to help support victims and, I guess, to support prosecution as well. I think it's important to note, because we've been talking about this a lot lately, that actually just in the last month, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act was reauthorized, and it was incorporated into the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, which we were very happy with, so that it could get reauthorized. We've been waiting for 2 years for that to happen. Under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, these are the definitions that are used on a legal level. So when we're talking about who's a victim of trafficking, we look at these definitions and we want to establish that there's been forced fraud or coercion used to compel a person into some form of labor or service. And that can, for us, that can be any form of labor or service. So for us, sex work falls into this definition all by itself. But the federal government, when they passed the TVPA, decided that they needed to separate these two forms of trafficking. So there is labor trafficking and there's sex trafficking under the federal law. Sex trafficking is a commercial sex act which is induced by forced fraud or coercion. And you'll notice the distinction, or in which the person performing the act is under the age of 18. Why this is important is that if somebody is under the age of 18 and is engaging in any kind of commercial sex, that means sex in exchange for anything of value. It could be a place to stay, it could be drugs, it could be money, it could be a variety of things. I think it's really important to note that that person under this law, under this definition, is considered a victim of human trafficking. And while that may or may not be important, it for a variety of reasons, one of the reasons it is important is that it does make people in that situation eligible for services that are specifically funded for victims of human trafficking. So I think for our purposes as victim service providers, that's where it's really important that we understand what the definition is. So these are the definitions we use. These are not criminal law definitions. There are all kinds of criminal laws that apply to human trafficking. And while these sort of summarize those laws, those are laws that prosecutors need to understand, and so we rely on them to worry about that. For our purposes, these are the ways that we define who may be a victim of human trafficking. Sometimes people also get confused that if somebody's not under 18 and they're involved in commercial sex, they can't be a victim of human trafficking, and that's not the case. If forced fraud or coercion are present, then that adult can be a victim of human trafficking as well. So I think that's an important point to make. That being said, we'll move on to the definition that we actually at Warren have created, because we think that it provides a broader overview of what human trafficking is. And because we believe that commercial sex is a form of labor and a form of work, we actually encompass that into this definition. So the use of force, fraud, or coercion to compel a person into any form of work against his or her will. Like I said, human trafficking occurs in many different types of labor or of work, and so it could be manual labor, retail, manufacturing, different service industries, commercial sex work, other illegal activities like drug sales, pretty much any industry or any money-making scheme you can think of, somebody can be compelled, and that could fall under human trafficking. So we just really want people to take a broad perspective on this. Not all human trafficking involves forced prostitution or forced sex work. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind. So a lot of times people are confused between the difference between smuggling and trafficking. A lot of people come up to us and will relay a story or facts that relate to smuggling and say and believe that that's human trafficking. And we want to be really clear that they are not the same thing. Smuggling is crossing a border without detection, and it's, as we all know, illegal. So crossing into the United States without immigration status or without documents is smuggling. And that can happen in a lot of different ways, where We've heard about people coming in through container ships, through a seaport. We've heard about people coming across a land border. Those things can happen in a variety of ways. Trafficking is really exploitation of an individual. It's not the movement of somebody. It really has to do with somebody being forced to some form of work or service against their will. And so what I always say is somebody can be born in Kirkland, Washington, and never leave Kirkland, Washington, and be a victim of human trafficking in Kirkland, Washington. So I think that that's really important to understand. And I think people are just misrepresented by the word trafficking. People think that means movement, and really it doesn't. It means the use of something or the exchanging of ownership of something. So it doesn't necessarily apply to human beings, that word, but that's the word they've chosen to use. And so I just want people to understand that there is a difference. I will say it's important to note that many of the cases of human trafficking that we see start out as a smuggling situation where someone says, I'm going to pay to have my family brought to the United States by this person. And then they get here and the trafficker, the smuggler says, oh, you know what? Because we faced all these obstacles in coming here, the fee that we agreed upon isn't enough. So we want you to pay us more money. And the only way you can pay that off is by doing this kind of work for us. That's when smuggling becomes trafficking. And certainly we see those situations. Okay, now I'm going to stop to poll you guys. So the first question we want to ask is, who do you think is vulnerable to human trafficking? So I think, Logan, is that open to everyone to start answering?
Yes, everyone should be able to start clicking, and then we'll show the results in just a second.
Okay, yep, I see results coming in. Wow, you guys are fast. Okay, we're over 30 results, so I'm going to go ahead and skip, and it'll change as we look at it. But, I hope that didn't close the poll. Anyway, you guys are good. You already know all of this. Basically, all of the people that we listed are vulnerable to human trafficking. Is there a way to, like, it's still adding up. Okay. So you all know, you already know this. You know that there's no one population or one quote-unquote poster child or demographic for human trafficking. Certainly there are people who are disproportionately affected by human trafficking, and I think you won't be surprised to hear that we have disproportionately seen women being represented as the survivors who we've identified and work with. That does not mean that we don't work with men and we don't work with children. Even though the discourse is often focused around youth and juveniles who've been forced into prostitution, certainly that is not the only population affected by this. Again, even within that population, we only hear about girls, young girls who are forced into I'm going to go back and see if there's any more responses. So certainly we hear a lot about young girls who are being forced by a pimp to work in prostitution or have been convinced by somebody to do that. And I just think it's really important to know in working with people who do outreach to youth and street-involved youth that boys and young men are just as affected by this, by both sex trafficking and other forms of trafficking, as women are. We actually have seen a tremendous number of young men who are brought from Central American countries and forced to sell drugs or forced into other forms of labor that they really didn't know that that's what they were getting into. We've seen tremendous number of cases of young teenage boys in that situation. So I always want to draw attention to, I think, the things that people won't expect while at the same time honoring the people who are disproportionately affected. We see a lot of women who are victims of trafficking that brought here to do domestic service, commercial sex work, other forms of labor, work in salons, work in restaurants. We definitely have had children who are victims of trafficking. We've had entire families where it's the mom, the dad, or a single parent and children, who all of whom are forced to work in some form of labor. So I think it's really important to have a broad purview on who can be affected by human trafficking. Clearly, able-bodied men are a key population that is forced and exploited through different forms of manual and hard labor, agricultural work, seasonal labor types of work. So we have actually had several cases involving the construction industry where immigrants have come here and worked in construction and been exploited and abused by their employers. So again, we really want to make sure we cover everything. We've served victims as young as 4 years old and victims in their 50s and 60s. So it's a whole range. I would say we've definitely seen more of our clients have been between the ages of 18 and probably 40 because obviously they're able-bodied, they're able to work, and that's the type of person that people are looking to provide labor and services. We've even had clients with really high levels of education who are professors and medical professionals in their home country. And then, of course, we've seen clients who came from a background of poverty, and even some clients who are illiterate. Many of our clients, particularly the women, have experienced a lifetime of abuse and trauma, making them vulnerable to trafficking. And, you know, often when somebody's trying to escape abuse that they've experienced throughout their lifetime, they really need, they're looking for something better. And when they have that opportunity, they will take it. So some people think that immigrant victims of trafficking are all smuggled into the U.S. And as I spoke about, some of them are. But actually, a lot of our clients come to the U.S. through some legal means. It could be a tourist visa, a fiancé visa, a work or a student visa, and then they become trapped in the exploitative trafficking situation, and they'll often overstay their visa, so they will be out of status, and therefore their traffickers use that against them because they're now illegal. So we have people who came here knowing what they thought they knew what they were getting into and ended up in a situation they had no control over, and then we have people who really didn't know what they were getting themselves into, didn't understand what they agreed to when they agreed to come to the U.S. So there's a variety of different people who we serve. I would say anytime you're dealing with somebody, regardless of age or gender, these are still things you want to listen for. Were they in a work situation that they didn't have any control over? Okay, next poll question. There aren't that many of these, but these are just grouped close together. Who do you think are the perpetrators of trafficking? They happen so fast. I love it. Okay, I'm going to skip to results because I'm just too excited. But you guys keep answering. Wow, you guys are too good. You know, you all understand this. So, again, and I swear not all of these questions are all of the above answers, but definitely all of these people are potential perpetrators of trafficking. It really can be anyone. We see many cases in which women are the traffickers, particularly with foreign national cases. I think that is such an important point to make because I don't think that the public discourse around human trafficking talks enough about this area. We've actually had several federal level prosecutions in which women were the defendants. And I think that that is really, really important for everybody to understand that just because someone who the person you're talking to might refer to as an auntie or as their mom or as, you know, someone who is their friend and that person's a woman does not mean that that person is not perpetrating exploitation against the victim. Many times the trafficker is someone known to the victim, a family member or a friend of the family. Sometimes it is a stranger who introduces the victim to someone he or she knows. It's really important to note that family members can be traffickers, and we've seen this a lot in some of the cases. And so we never want to dismiss, and I'm sure all of you as service providers have experienced this, we just don't want to dismiss something because it involves a family member. Oftentimes, relatives have more power to control a victim than strangers do. We've seen cases in which seemingly, and I'm using air quotes but you can't see me, normal married couples or normal families are the traffickers of a domestic servant or of other people. We've had a few cases in which the traffickers were professionals. We had one with medical professionals. We had another in which the husband was an engineer and the wife was a nurse. You can imagine their surprise and resentment at being faced with human trafficking charges at the federal level. It's really, really just important to remember that it's not always some underground organized crime network or gang. It can be people who seem very familiar to us and that we would never suspect are abusing somebody in their home or in their workplace. In my experience doing this work, human trafficking really is a form of interpersonal violence or abuse, and it doesn't always involve like some big organized crime syndicate. In fact, most of the cases we've seen in Washington have been more on the level of interpersonal control, abuse, and exploitation. Because of this, sexual assault actually can be involved in trafficking cases of all kinds. And we've seen a lot of cases where a victim of domestic servitude is sexually assaulted by the husband in the family, or a woman working in agricultural industry is forced to have sex with her supervisor in order to keep her job and not be turned into immigration. So definitely we see a lot of cases where sexual assault might be the first indicator or the first thing reported, but in reality there's more going on than just that. Not that that's just, but you know what I mean. With pimp-involved prostitution, which is often referred to as quote-unquote domestic sex trafficking, basically what that means is it means a sex trafficking case in which a domestic victim is involved. Often the trafficker is the boyfriend, or is at least referred to by the victim as the boyfriend, as her boyfriend. Generally speaking, in those cases, we're seeing female victim and male pimp or trafficker. Sometimes there are girls who work for the trafficker to sort of enforce his rules on the other girls. They're referred to as a bottom or main girl. There's also other street terms for them, but I tend to shy away from using them because I don't think it's necessary. But I will say that oftentimes this is a means of survival for that person. And it's not, they aren't doing it because, you know, that's what they would do. They're doing it because that was the way for them to survive and avoid being beaten and being forced into prostitution as much. With sex trafficking cases involving foreign nationals, we often see women who are sort of the head honcho in a residential brothel or something, or a massage parlor type case. So I always want to keep people aware of that. I think it's really also important to note that when we talk about pimp-involved prostitution or sex trafficking, that's not the only form of trafficking that street-involved youth experience. Some of our partners who do outreach to street-involved youth see this playing out in different ways. For example, we've heard stories of like two young people who sort of bond together and sort of form an alliance to survive on the streets. And one will maybe convince the other to sell sex as a means to make money for both of them. So, you know, I'm not saying that either of them needs to be prosecuted. I'm just saying that this is one form that that can take. And I think that, again, we have to open our minds to what this might look like. So we want to talk about some of the different forms of trafficking. I've already touched on some of them, but I think that we use these images in order to try to be as broad as possible, and I can't talk enough about being really broad in our perspective on where trafficking can happen and where it can be taking place. Domestic servitude is a huge area that we have been able to identify and serve victims coming out of that. And again, you know, when I talk about the people we've identified and worked with, I think it's also really important to note that those are the people we've identified and worked with. And the nature of human trafficking is so, so hidden that we're not always going to know what really is happening out there. We only are able to know what we've heard directly from the people we've served. So I want everyone to be aware of that. And again, that just speaks back to broadening our perspective on what could be human trafficking. Domestic servitude cases usually play out where the individual has been recruited or offered a job or a position to work for a family in the United States as a housekeeper or a nanny. Often, it may be they've been introduced by the family here from by someone they know back in their home country. They may have worked for another family member of the people they're coming to work for. There may be a variety of ways in which they're brought here. We also have seen domestic servitude within families where young children are brought to the United States as adopted children or brought here as a niece or a nephew, and then forced to perform domestic service within the home. And again, that even a young child as young as 13 could be forced to provide childcare for younger children of the family. They can be forced to do a variety of different chores. We had a client as young as 4 years old that was forced to do different types of housework within a family unit. And so we've seen that a lot. We've also had cases where older people were forced to provide domestic service to their daughter and son-in-law. So, again, family-related. We've also had other cases in which there was not a family relation, but where somebody brought over a domestic servant because they had achieved success in the United States and wanted to sort of flaunt their new status, and that gave them status to have a domestic servant in the home. So that's the type of thing we see with domestic servitude. We also see human trafficking in small retail businesses like restaurant work, nail salons, where, you know, again, the people ultimately don't have the ability to choose that work. They're being threatened or they're being controlled because they owe a debt to the business owner. And so we also want to look for abuse and exploitation in those types of businesses. I've talked a little bit about farm work and agricultural cases. We definitely see those in Western Washington as well as Eastern Washington. And, you know, again, it's not that every migrant farm worker is a victim of human trafficking. They may be not making enough money. They may be doing really, really hard labor. But the ultimate question is it their choice to do that work? Do they feel that they can leave that without being threatened or without facing some kind of threat, whether it's immigration, the threat of being deported, or the threat of their family members being harmed? Those are the types of questions we want to ask when we're talking about this. And that's what it comes down to. It's not just because someone's here working for $3 a day. Unfortunately, that is a labor violation. It just is not human trafficking without more. So I also want to talk about, and I already did a little bit about ways sexual assault and human trafficking intersect. We, as I mentioned, we see sexual assault in a lot of non-sex-related trafficking cases. And I talked about those where a woman who's a domestic servant may be sexually assaulted by the man in the house, or farm workers may be sexually assaulted as a means of control. We certainly see that with male workers as well, and it's even harder to detect because, as I'm sure you can imagine, they are really unlikely to come forward and report the sexual assault for fear that someone will find out that they were sexually assaulted by another man. But we definitely hear of those types of cases. Obviously, when we talk about sex work, we're usually looking at multiple sexual assaults, and I think we can assume that if the person you're working with has been involved in commercial sex work, they have experienced sexual assault and abuse, whether they're reporting it or not. This is one way, though, that some sexual assault providers have come to serve victims of human trafficking and to work with us, because they will continue to provide them services as sexual assault providers, but then they will reach out to us to provide additional services and case management for other aspects of the trafficking the person experienced. We really appreciate that type of collaboration, and we want to make sure that that happens. The picture in the bottom left corner with the woman in handcuffs, I think it's important to note that we actually have had victims detected at detention centers and in jail, and we've been able to serve them even when they are still detained. We really try to serve people where they are at, and we do see that happen sometimes. So, again, in that situation, that person may be demonstrating a completely different situation, but ultimately, with people listening and asking the right questions, we're able to find out that they are a victim of human trafficking. We have the picture of the child. In the corner, we, as I mentioned before, we do see a lot of children who are forced to do different forms of work. And I, Myra Jimenez. Well, Logan, I'll let you handle that question. So we do see children in a variety of form work, and I mentioned the young men who have been brought here, young, I say young men, but really they're boys under the age of 18, sometimes 14 or 16 years old, brought here to do a variety of different types of work. We have definitely seen young men from, young boys from Central America brought here to engage in drug sales, and street level, drug sales. So, we want people to be aware that somebody might be presenting as a drug dealer, when in reality they've been forced into that form of work. I didn't talk much, I talked a little bit about, street level and pimp involved prostitution. I want to talk about sex work involving foreign nationals for a moment because the types we see are quite different than what we see with U.S. citizens. And in those cases, usually we're looking at a residential based, sex business. So, something in a house or a condo or an apartment. So, it's really hard for people to wrap their minds around, but I always tell people that there's actually been several cases, identified by law enforcement and, revealed by law enforcement in within a couple mile radius of where my mom lives. So I always want to tell people, like, this isn't happening on the wrong side of the tracks, and it's not necessarily happening in some business or on some street corner, or only on the internet. You know, this could be happening in the house down the street or in the apartment building down the street in really nice areas, around, you know, where we live. So just to keep your mind open to the different forms that this can take. I already talked a little bit about pimp-involved prostitution and street-level sex work, and I think I'm not going to spend too much time on that because I think that the public discourse has really presented that issue a lot. I think there's a lot of misrepresentations out there, and I think for you as service providers, you're more familiar with what that may look like. But certainly that's another form that human trafficking can take. Oh, now we're to the next poll question. Now that you've heard a little bit about the different forms that human trafficking can take in the different cases we've seen in Washington, can you answer this question? Do you believe you've encountered or worked with victims of human trafficking in your work? I'm watching the results come in. Wow. A lot of you have. That's amazing. I'm happy to hear that you've been able to identify people as victims of human trafficking. I'm hoping that this training will better help you know the resources that are available to those the people who have experienced that. Again, I always think it's important to note that all of these definitions and all this ability to identify people as victims of trafficking, to me, the most important aspect of it is so that we can refer them to appropriate services based on that identification, not because some case is going to be prosecuted. I mean, that's great when that happens, and I think it can be really empowering for victims to actually watch go through prosecution. It can also be really traumatic. So I just want to, you know, say that I think the most important reason we want to understand what human trafficking is so that we can access services and benefits related to that that are available to us. And we'll talk more about that as we go. Next, we're doing two in a row this time. I guess this is a similar question, but have you ever directly served anyone identified as a victim of trafficking? And I'll be interested to see if the responses are different because even if now that you've heard about it, you realize you have worked with someone, were they identified at the time you were serving them? Looks like it's a little bit different, so that's interesting. And hopefully, you know, and I think, you know, a lot of times when we do these presentations in person, we hear from people, you know, I absolutely worked with somebody who had all of these indicators, but I didn't know what it was at the time. And it's still, you know, everything may have gone fine and that person may have had the ability to access services anyway. But it is interesting that I think that this comes up, that people really do figure out that they have directly worked with somebody who was a victim of trafficking and have that experience. So One of the things I love about live presentations is that we can actually talk to you about your experiences, because I know some stuff, but you all know lots of things I would love to learn from you as well. So hopefully we'll get the chance to interact and learn from you. So I've talked about some of this already, but I think oftentimes people will say, you know, just like in domestic violence or other interpersonal forms of violence, why doesn't somebody leave a situation, or why don't they come forward and ask for help? And as we all know, there are so many factors that keep somebody trapped in a situation. I would say of these, in my experience, threats are probably the most effective form of control that traffickers use against their victims, particularly threats to family members. In cases involving both immigrants and U.S. citizens, we often hear that traffickers threaten family members, and the fear of those threats really keep victims in the situation longer. Generally, when somebody decides to leave a trafficking situation, it's because they're willing to take the chance that there's something better out there. What I have heard from so many people I've worked with is that they didn't leave because at least what the situation they were in was known to them, and they weren't sure what else was out there, whether they were ever going to find somebody they could trust, whether they were going to be, anybody was going to help them, whether they'd even be able to communicate. They often believe very strongly that they are going to be deported because their traffickers will tell them, if you leave, I'm going to call immigration and you're going to get deported. And that's a really pervasive threat and fear in immigrant communities. And so I think it's really important to be aware of that fear. And one of the things we like to do right away when we're working with someone who we have identified as a victim of human trafficking is to say, you're not going to be deported. We're going to do, you know, there's no reason for us to believe that that will happen. And I will say that of the people we have worked with, once identified, we have never had anyone deported. That doesn't mean I don't believe that victims of human trafficking are deported in the immigration system on a regular basis. It's not. It's probably because they haven't been identified or nobody's asked the right question. So I don't want to sound like it's this happy paradise where nobody gets deported, because that's not true. But we do like to reassure people that there are protections for them and that we're going to help them to get immigration advocacy and pursue those types of protections. Obviously, a lot of the people we work with report to us that they didn't know they had any rights, that they thought they'd gotten themselves into the situation and they just didn't know, they didn't think they could get out. And so there's a lot of reasons why people don't leave. I list here loyalty as a coping mechanism. We see that in a lot of cases, and I think most of you would probably assume that in pimp-involved prostitution, when somebody's referring to their abuser as their boyfriend, that there's loyalty there, and that's what we're talking about. We actually see that with other forms of trafficking as well. A lot of times domestic servants will tell us, you know, I raised those children. I don't want them to be without their parents. I didn't want to leave them alone in that situation. Or so there's a lot of different ways that loyalty to the trafficker can interfere with somebody's ability to leave the situation. I think we've covered most of these, but I always like to sort of summarize some of the indicators. I don't necessarily advocate for a strict formal intake process, but we do. We just hope that providers can develop a relationship with somebody they're serving and then listen for these types of indicators as that relationship progresses. I do think it's worth noting, and I've said this already, that identifying someone as a victim of human trafficking does not usually expedite immediate response or access to services. The reason we ask people to try to look for these things is in order to offer them services that they're eligible for because they're a victim of human trafficking. And when I talk about that, you know, you all understand funding restrictions, and we, you know, we have the same funding restrictions that a lot of other people have. Our funding is here to serve victims of human trafficking. Now, when I get a call from somebody else who doesn't quite fit that eligibility, we certainly refer them to other programs and other services. We don't just walk away from them. So I don't want you to ever feel worried about calling us, even if you're not 100% sure that something's a trafficking situation. So again, these are just some of the things you can look for when you're working for someone. As I mentioned before, poor working conditions and even like no pay are not enough alone. The real question is whether or not the potential victim had the ability to leave the work situation. It might not be obvious right at face value. They might not be have been physically prevented from leaving, but once you start building a relationship and learning about their experience, it might come to the surface that threats and coercion that the traffickers have used had made the victim feel like they could not leave. Often with sex trafficking, we hear victims say they do it because they want to and it's their choice, and we do not want to interfere with their own self-determination. But sometimes as you work with somebody, it becomes even more clear to them that they were handing over all the money they were being paid, or they weren't able to make their own choices. They really were being controlled by someone. And in those situations, you know, it can come through. We certainly don't want to force anyone to self-identify as a victim. In fact, we actually don't refer to our clients in that way when we're talking to them. We'll say, because of what you've been through, you're eligible for certain services and certain benefits, and we want to help you access those services. And so, yes, the word victim does come up when we're working with people, and we explain what that means. But when we talk to our clients, we tell them that we believe they are survivors, and we really do, because they have survived so much. Even if they're not completely on the other end of recovery or on the other end of going through the situation, they already have survived a heck of a lot. And so we want to honor that and really not label them in any way. I'm just going to go through these really fast. I'm not going to go through all these questions. I just like to give you a list of questions that you may ask. Again, not through a formal intake process or a formal screening process, but as you're developing a relationship with someone, as you're talking to someone, these are some of the questions that may come up to help you establish whether that person is in this situation. And there's just a few more. So we're to our next poll question. Now that we've talked about ways to identify potential victims of human trafficking, do you know what resources exist to serve immigrants and youth in your area? Oh, you guys are so awesome. Most of you do, and that's wonderful because, you know, we really believe in collaborating and networking with providers around us because we know we can't be all things to all people. Excuse me, I have to clear my throat. So whether or not your agency has the ability to provide services to someone in the situation, it's highly likely that survivors of human trafficking will need services beyond your specific agent, what your specific agency can provide. We, WARN, as a program, work with many providers in order to provide an array of services our clients need. We provide intensive case management, but we access resources like medical care, counseling, interpretation, education, job training, and other services from other providers. As I just said, we know we cannot be all things to all people, and I hope we all know that because I think that that's the best way that we can serve the people we are. And while I am so happy that over 80% of you know what resources exist for immigrants and youth in your area, I am going to talk about I'm going to talk about the services that WARN provides, just so that you have a sense of what we can do. I'm also going to talk about ways that your agency can tap into. I think I have that on there. I hope. Funding that you can use to serve immigrant victims of human trafficking. And I'm sorry, again, it's a funding restriction. Our program serves all victims of human trafficking, regardless of immigration status, but there is another program that does provide some funding to serve immigrant victims, and we'll talk about that as we go. Serving survivors of trafficking. If you identify someone who's a victim of trafficking, you can always call us for assistance, and we will give that contact information at the end. You can refer the case to us, or we can provide technical assistance and support to you as you serve the client. So we've definitely done that. We've had people out in far away places that don't want to be, you know, transferred into Seattle or don't want to work in Seattle, and we just from a distance provide as much technical assistance and support as we can. We've served clients as far away as you can get from Seattle and Washington State. So basically Spokane on one end and Forks on the other. And we've tried to provide support around that. So, you know, please use us as a resource when you have this need. I'm not going to go into every detail of victim advocacy because I know that most of you are victim advocates and providers, and so I'm just going to sort of cover a couple of things that apply to victims of trafficking. All of the clients we have served have been traumatized by their trafficking experience and possibly by other things that they have experienced in their life. Some of our clients have been in trafficking situations for as little as 2 to 3 months, and some have been in there for almost 20 years. So we don't ever know what we're going to experience. So we really try to be as trauma-informed as we can. We are not mental health providers, so it's not the level that mental health providers would have as far as being trauma-educated and informed, but we do take every opportunity we can to work and learn from people around trauma and to work with our clients. I can tell you, and I'm sure you all already know this, our client, each and every one of our clients demonstrates trauma in very different ways. Some are very, very emotional. Some show very little emotion. Some talk a lot. And with some, it's really difficult for them to talk about what they've been through. We just really try hard to explain what's happening to our client, who we are, why we're there, so that they can feel that they understand the situation and feel as comfortable as possible with us. We've rarely had someone just come to us and say, I'm a victim of human trafficking, please help me, or to call us and say that. I will say this is happening a lot more often with the exposure and awareness around human trafficking right now. So it's sort of an interesting situation to deal with because when you have someone call and self-identify as a victim, you have to figure out what their understanding of human trafficking is and whether or not that's really true. Either way, again, we try to provide first, a needs assessment to figure out what it is that they need, and then we try to talk about whether or not they've experienced trafficking in the under the definitions we talked about. Our clients, I already talked about self-identifying even after we were working with them, and that's, you know, not something that our clients define. That's not a way that our clients define themselves, and I'm sure you have experienced that too. The way I explain who we are is to say that we try to help people who are caught in a situation they did not expect and have little control over. And that has been a pretty effective way to describe. And I use really very simple language with all of our clients because while we're all working in this world with all these words that we understand, we have to realize that our clients aren't in the same, you know, profession that we are in necessarily. And so we try to use very simple, common language that is very understandable when we explain what we do. We try to check in with our client from the very beginning to make sure he or she understands what we're saying. Checking in with someone whose first language is not English usually means saying more than do you understand. In fact, actually, I would say that's true for all clients. And one of the techniques that we employ is to say, can you tell me what you understand? Or can you tell me what I just said? And so really asking them to repeat to us what they understand so that we can clarify and make sure that they're really informed on the level that they can be. I just saw a question come through. How do your clients find you? Our clients, the tremendous number of our clients are referred by other service providers, by community-based organizations. So we do a tremendous amount of outreach to those who are trusted in vulnerable communities so that they can refer people to us. As I mentioned at the beginning, we do work with law enforcement and we do get a number of referrals from law enforcement, but the number of referrals we get from community-based providers and service providers far outweighs the number that we get from law enforcement or other sources. So I think that's a great question. I'm so glad you asked it because that's why we do trainings like this, so that we know the people who are trusted in a community understand how to identify trafficking and also understand the types of services we provide. I'm just going to quickly go through some of our values. I talked about self-determination earlier, and it's just really important to us that our clients are making their own decisions. They've been controlled through the trafficking situation, and a lot of their freedom has been removed, and so we really want to give that back to them. And so these are the kinds of things that we always are trying to remember and bring to the work that we do. Sometimes our clients make decisions we don't agree with. It's probably the hardest part of our job is to allow them to make their own decisions, to inform them, maybe even advise them as to what we think the way to go is, but to also constantly reiterate that it's up to them. We let them know the types of services we provide and let them choose what their needs are and to prioritize their own needs. You know, again, this takes a tremendous amount of time, and but these are the things that we try to focus on. The reason the word rescue is crossed out at the bottom is because that is not one of our values. Despite the fact that we work for an organization called the International Rescue Committee, by the way, that's been the name of our organization for 80 years, so I don't think it's going to change. We really don't believe in rescue because our clients really do that hard work themselves. They are the ones who leave a trafficking situation or an abusive situation. They come to us and we basically provide access to services and we provide support around moving forward from the trafficking experience. So there are a lot of people who talk about we need to save the girls who are victims of trafficking. We need to rescue the victims. And really, we are not, that's not our area of expertise. Certainly, some law enforcement people perform rescue-type operations. We really, you know, that's really just removing somebody from a situation of immediate danger. What we really work with our clients to do is to help them restore their power and help them become self-sufficient. So enough said about that, but that's how we do things. I'm going to talk a little bit about working with interpreters. I'm sure that you have all had this experience. I hope that you have. It's so, so, so important when you're working with someone whose first language is not English to make sure that you can tap into interpretation services. I'm not saying you need to pay $75 an hour for a court-certified interpreter. I don't think that's necessary to provide services, but I do think it's important to have established relationship with as many interpreters as you can so that you can tap into them when you need to. It's important they have prior experience working with victims. They understand confidentiality. It's important that you do not use a family member or a friend of the client you're working with, because even if they say it's okay, that person has a conflict of interest potentially in interpreting for the client. It's important that interpreters are independent and neutral, and that they don't express any of their own opinions or beliefs. I will often say to an interpreter before we work with them, I really want you to strictly interpret just what I say and just what the client says. Please do not add any of your own commentary or have side discussions with the client outside of strict interpretation. I know it might sound condescending or rude. I think it's important that we have these conversations. Our first priority is our client, and so we have to actually make sure that we're working with somebody who understands this. We also recommend that you have an interpreter sign a confidentiality agreement to reinforce that nothing he or she hers will be repeated. When you say confidentiality, we have a question. When you say confidentiality, you mean the interpreter needs to sign an agreement. Okay, so that's what I just talked about. We think that that's a really good practice to have in place. Most of the interpreters we've worked with have been very good, but we've had some really horrible experiences where interpreters have told the client that they are lying, told the client that they know the person they're talking about and that they should stop talking to us and just go back to that abuser. And we do not ever want that to happen. I think it's really important to use your powers of observation, even when you don't speak whatever language is being spoken, to see how comfortable your client is with that interpreter and to make sure that nothing is going wrong. So to answer your question, yes, I think signing a confidentiality agreement is absolutely great practice to have. And I also think it's just really important to vet these interpreters as much as possible. We've had some really bad experiences. We've also had some really great experiences. We work with a couple of interpreters who, when they take notes during an interview with a client, will actually give their notes to the client after the interview and say, these are yours, to reassure the client that nothing that has been said is going to be repeated. They will also, some really other good practices, an interpreter will say to a client, if I ever see you outside of this office or outside of this meeting space, no one will have any reason to know that we know each other. Those are other really good practices that interpreters use. And as you work with different interpreters, you'll get to know people that have really good practices. So another question, do you have samples of confidentiality agreements for interpreters? I could probably come up with some, yeah. And I assume if you have some places that have confidential locations, you will have somebody sign an agreement not to reveal the location, somebody who comes to your office. So it would look something like that. But, yeah, I may be able to provide that to WICSAP, and then they can provide it. WICSAP may also have some examples of confidentiality agreements. Cultural considerations. I just want to, again, I hope many of you have had experience working with people from different backgrounds. And I think it's important understanding cultural differences is important when working with all victims of trafficking, both immigrants and domestic victims. As an example, I do not share a lot of cultural experience with a 16-year-old street-involved youth. Whether or not we were born and raised in the same town or, you know, doesn't matter. So I just think it's important to realize that your culture is not going to be the same as somebody just because you might share the same ethnicity or even the same same geographic background. I actually don't believe in the word cultural competency because I don't think any one of us can be completely competent in someone else's culture. But we can be sensitive to it. And I think what we can try to do is to understand that culture may create difficult communications and actually may create a barrier to someone receiving services. So what we try to do is we ask about someone's culture. What kind of food can you eat? Are there restrictions that would prevent you from staying in a certain housing facility? We actually had a client who unexpectedly just started asking to go home when she had indicated that she wanted to stay in the United States, and we couldn't figure it out. And what turned out we finally were able to discover was that there were people that stayed in the same housing facility as she did that were cooking pork in the kitchen, and that was violating her religious values. And so once we understood that, we were able to find a more appropriate place for her to stay. But instead of asking us to do that, she just thought she should just ask to go home. And so but really asking those questions, I think the other thing is a lot of times we'll make assumptions because, I've worked with somebody who is from Vietnam before, so I know everything about that culture, and I know exactly what the Vietnamese people are like. And I think that that's a really bad assumption to make. I think that we need to talk to our clients, provide individualized services, and ask them about the things that they believe in and the values that they have as much as we can. We also may not be able to ask all the right questions, and so just being aware that barriers we're running into with a client may come from those things. I also think we need to be aware of our own biases. We all have them, and I think the more that we're aware of them, the better we can avoid having them disrupt the services we're providing. And I just think that's a really important thing. The other thing that I like to there's another question. Oh, WICSAP, that's from WICSAP, sorry. So another thing when we talk about culture, we just like to look at the different things. So if you make an assumption that you understand all Chinese people because you've worked with somebody from that ethnicity before, look at all the different ways that the different cultures that these people can, that Chinese people can experience. They could be living and working in New York. They might be a well-educated lesbian doctor in Germany. They could be a Chinese teenager who was adopted by Jewish parents and living in France. I mean, these are just such diverse cultural experiences that somebody who at face value appears to be quote-unquote Chinese. There's so much more to it. And so I think that this is just an example of not making assumptions around ethnic culture, but really asking the questions of an individual what their cultural values are. So I talked to you a little bit about, you know, the first thing we try to do when we encounter someone, and I'm sure it's something similar to what you do, is to figure out what their needs are. We do provide somewhat urgent response. I would say it's not, we don't run out and pick somebody up off the street because they're asking for assistance. And I think most providers don't do that. I will say that, you know, the first thing we ask about is safety. Safety, and one way that we ask this is, how are you keeping yourself safe? As opposed to, are you safe? Because somebody might say, no, I'm not safe. If I go out, they're going to find me, or the people that have been abusing me are going to find me, or if I leave, they're going to chase me and they're going to hurt me. And so in the moment, they might be physically safe, but they don't feel safe. And so talking about, well, what are ways to keep yourself safe, and talking about safety around those different things, and talking about that need, and then suggesting different ways that somebody can keep themselves safe. Again, this goes to self-determination and client-driven services. We want our clients to make the decisions around their safety, and we can help them. There are also times when a client wants us to engage the help of our law enforcement partners to keep them safe. Now, whether or not that's an ideal way to keep somebody safe is another conversation. And so we, again, talk about our experience and what that may look like. We also talk about calling 911 and what that will look like and how to get help that way. And then, you know, a lot of times the calls we get are, hi, I'm a victim of human trafficking and I need a safe place to stay tonight. And, you know, because our services are so much more broad and deep than just providing somebody with a emergency shelter, we actually have to, you know, really offer the resources that we have to offer and information about our program, but we also really try to help somebody in that situation advocate for themselves and access housing options that are available. Saying the word human trafficking is not like waving a magic wand and suddenly all kinds of resources are going to open up that didn't exist before. I think that's really important because that is a lot of times what people think. And there is no secret housing available to victims of human trafficking that you all don't already know about or that's not already publicly available to service providers helping clients seek housing. So I just want to say that. This is a list of all the things that we provide when we're talking about urgent response. One of the big things is offering a telephone or a phone card so that our clients can call loved ones. They may have been out of touch with people for a really long time. And sometimes in our experience, the first thing they say is, oh, I really, really want to call my parents. But then once we give them that phone card, they're actually not ready to have that conversation yet. They realize that what's going to happen when they answer the phone. So that might take some time and some emotional and moral support as well as counseling around getting there. Culturally appropriate food. What does the client want to eat? When was the last time they ate? Just really asking these questions and trying to assess what somebody needs. They, in my experience, most of the people we've worked with will prioritize their needs for you and will let you know exactly what the thing that they're most concerned about is in the moment. And so we want to react to that because a lot of times they can't have subsequent conversations about anything else until one of those needs is taken care of. Options. You may be working with somebody who does not want to be referred to WARN or come forward. And I think, it's important that we reassure clients that in order to access services, they are not required to report to law enforcement. We really just try to inform clients that they may have options. I am going to talk about immigration protection for victims of human trafficking, but I don't think that's anything we should ever promise to somebody. I think what we need to say is there may be immigration options for you based on the experience you've had. Explaining to someone that if they believe they owed their trafficker a debt, that they don't need to worry about that anymore, that they are safe from and protected from owing that debt. Explaining to them what their rights are, that they have rights here regardless of what their situation's been. We've had U.S. citizen clients who said, well, I've been arrested a lot of times. You know what? That doesn't matter. What matters to us is that you need services right now, and let's figure out what those are. So we really want them to be as informed as possible about their options and make their own decisions. They certainly do not have to work with WARN. They do not have to work with any of us if they don't want to, but we want to give them the option. So our next poll question is, have you ever referred a client to WARN? Just so I can get a sense of if we've worked with any of you. Oh, this one's harder for me to reveal. But I hope that after this we'll change it. So lots of you have not referred clients to us, and I hope that we can change that, and I hope that we can, even if you haven't referred clients to us, that we can work with you to serve people who are in this situation in the future. I was going to ask a follow-up question to this, and if you feel comfortable filling the answer into the chat box, this would be great. Now that you've been on this webinar, is there anything more you need to know in order to feel comfortable referring a client to Warren or calling Warren for assistance? I guess I don't want to say, ask you whether you're comfortable now, because then I'll just get a bunch of yeses or nos. I really want to say, is there more information you'd like from us in order to be able to feel comfortable working with us? So go ahead and use the chat box if you have any comments on that. I was just going to get to that. So one of the comments is, one of the worst moments for survivors are interviews with law enforcement or ICE or attorneys. Sometimes they have to go over their story so many times and risk re-victimization. You are absolutely right, and it is a really hard thing. What we try to do, just so that you know, with our intake process, we try to limit the information that somebody needs to share as much as possible. As when we go back to the beginning of that, looking at that definition, we just need to establish if they've been in a forced labor situation or whether they've been, exploited under the definition of human trafficking. And so we don't make them go through their whole story. That being said, yes, of course, if they do decide to report to law enforcement, that interview process is can be extremely traumatizing. And I'll tell you a little bit about what we do to empower our clients in that process. I actually have a slide coming up on that, but I'll just get into it now. We talk extensively to our clients before they make this decision about what the process looks like and what it's going to be like. We try to empower them through the process. We say, you know, you're in charge of this meeting with law enforcement. You have the right to answer which questions you want to answer, not answer the questions you don't want to answer. And the law enforcement officials that we work with are human trafficking specific agent. And so they understand being victim-centered, they understand trauma, and they are actually really, really good with working with our clients. And so what we're able to say to our clients is, we're going to introduce you to somebody, if you want to, we can introduce you to somebody who wants to help you. So even though they're law enforcement and they have a badge, they're not somebody you need to be afraid of. They're somebody who wants to help you. And so that's part of the process that we go through. We spend a tremendous amount of time preparing our clients for this. I will say also, working with immigration attorneys is also re-traumatizing, because they have to go through their story in order to submit a declaration in order to get immigration relief. So think it's, you know, really important to prepare our clients for that, and also to work with attorneys who understand how hard that process is, and also to work with mental health counselors. We need our clients to have that kind of support when they are going through this process again. And we do, again, just like I said before, we try to know the people we work with, even if it's, whether it's interpreters or other providers. We aren't going to work with an unknown entity. We want to work with people who understand a trauma-informed approach to this type of service. I'm going to move on because there's other questions. Frank, I see your question from Yakima. We can talk about that later. Heidi, how do you verify credentials of others? Again, we try to build relationships. So, yeah, we don't work with any unlicensed housing providers, for instance. We work with established housing providers. We work with established providers for counseling service. And if it is an unknown entity, we actually do try to get to know them before we refer a client to them. So both myself and our case managers will make efforts to do that. Like I said, we do all these this training and outreach to service providers and community-based organizations, and part of that is building relationships. So we do make sure that the people we work with are qualified to serve our clients in a trauma-informed way. Somebody sharing experience. Usually law enforcement is good and fast when the survivor is from the sex field, but when they're from labor, it's not so easy. I agree with you, and that goes back to building relationships with people who are informed and dedicated to this type of work. And I know that that's really hard. We experience the same thing often. But we do have a few agents here in Washington who we can reliably turn to on any kind of human trafficking case. And they're no less interested in non-sex labor cases than they are in sex work cases. So again, it's baby steps. It's definitely not perfect all across the United States or even across Washington State. But I will say, if you guys, any of you in Washington, ever have a question about working with law enforcement on a trafficking situation, please give me a call and I can refer you to people who we know, who are good. So the question, what is a good way to inform local law enforcement not in Washington about human trafficking, unique set of circumstances that they present? Great question. Work with other law enforcement who do understand this. Just like us, law enforcement is more likely to respond to training from people within their own field. And if you want to get in touch with me after this, I can talk to you about some of the trainers in different parts of the country who do work out of law enforcement agencies. And we can talk about maybe people who might be good for you to connect with. I'm assuming you're not in Washington, so feel free to send me an email, and I will connect you with folks in the area you're in, and hopefully you can build a response with them. So I've already gone through a lot of this, but I just want to reiterate, these are the types of services that WARN provides to victims of trafficking. It really is intensive case management. And I don't want to not note that we understand that what we're able to provide because of our funding is often more extensive than what is available to people who are victims of other crimes. And, you know, we're really lucky that we have the funding to be able to provide, food and clothing and basic needs to people who have no other means of support. Our case managers do work really intensively with clients. They will show them how to ride the bus. They show them where the grocery store is. They help them budget with the services we can provide. They go to the doctor with them. And we support them through the criminal justice system when that's something that they choose. It's really, really intensive. So, you know, we're happy to assist other people in providing these services, but we also understand that that's not always within the capacity. There's a question about printing it out. The WICSAP will provide access to the presentation online. I think we've already gone over this. Oops, back. Don't answer the poll question yet. If you do decide to call us, this is our 24-hour victim assistance line. We really ask that calls after hours to this line really be specifically related to an urgent need from a potential victim. During the day, you can call us anytime, and we'll talk to you about what you're seeing, whether something is trafficking or not. Anytime you call, we certainly won't know who you are on the other line, so it is completely confidential. And we're happy to talk to you anonymously or confidentially. That's no problem. We'll try to explain, based on what you're seeing or who you're working with, we'll try to explain everything that we can from our knowledge base. We don't know everything, and we learn from providers like you all the time. So, you know, we just want you to know what to expect when you call us. You don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to worry about us reporting to law enforcement. You don't have to worry about us calling you back if you don't want us to call you back. We just really want to be there and act as a resource for you. Next poll question. Oh, do you feel comfortable referring a victim or after this webinar, I guess, referring somebody, a client to WARN or calling WARN for technical assistance? I hope we get yeses. But don't say yes if you don't mean it. Okay, it's looking good. Nobody's uncomfortable yet. Okay, we did very well. on that one. Thank you. I'm really glad that you feel good about that. And that's what we're here to do, is to be a resource for you all. And we'll just move on. I told you I'd talk a little bit about immigration relief that's available to victims of trafficking. These are the forms of relief. Continued presence is available only to victims of human trafficking, and it is a short-term form of relief that provides victims with 1 year of basically, it prevents them from being deported for a year, and it gives them work authorization as well. It's not, it is a form of status, but it's very short-term. I will say that as an investigation or a case proceeds, sometimes continued presence will be renewed after a year because the client hasn't achieved another more permanent status at that point. A T visa is specifically a visa for victims of human trafficking, and that can be applied for with the help of an immigration attorney. We refer all of our clients to pro bono immigration attorneys, and so they can work with them to apply for a T visa. It does require a declaration, and it also requires that almost every person applying for a T visa is required to cooperate with law enforcement on the investigation and prosecution of the trafficking. I want to say that that cooperation can range from simply reporting what happened all the way to testifying in a trial of the trafficker. And most of our experience has been our clients have not been made to testify, so I don't want people to worry about that. But we can talk more detail about that. U visas is a form of relief for victims of a variety of crimes, including human trafficking. Same requirement of cooperating with law enforcement. Again, we try to make that process as easy as possible. There may be other forms of relief, which is why we want our clients to work with victims of human trafficking or work with pro bono immigration attorneys so that they can explore what their options are before they make the decision whether or not to go forward with working with law enforcement. So that's a very brief overview of that. I already talked about criminal investigation and how we support our clients through that. We really are painstaking about explaining the process in advance so that our clients as much as possible know what to expect and know and it can ask us questions. But I think I already went into a lot of that. As a victim advocate, do you already have a relationship with law enforcement in your area? This is great. Really good. We're so happy to hear this. It looks like a lot of you already do. I would say, you know, one of the things is to build from the relationships you already have and see, are the law enforcement agents or officers that you work with interested in learning more about human trafficking? Might they be the key to getting more information into that particular law enforcement department? So I just really happy to hear this and would advise to build on those relationships. If you don't and you are in Washington State, get in touch with us and we'll try to help you start establishing those types of relationships. One last thing I want to touch on. If there is somebody who's an immigrant here and a victim of human trafficking and they just want to go home, we can help access that option for them. So I won't go deeply into this, but we will. That is something we can help them with. I think I've talked a lot about local response to human trafficking, but this is just an overview. We, as I said, we are part of the Washington Advisory Committee on Trafficking. We actually co-chair that group along with Seattle Police Department and the U.S. Attorney's Office for Western Washington. So that's just so you know, there is a local response in Washington State, and we can connect you to those who are involved if you want to be. There's also a national response, and we just like to let people know that there are ways for folks to look at national agencies and the types of things that they do around human trafficking. We are funded by these two agencies, Department of Justice and Department of Health and Human Services. Department of Health and Human Services also has a website where you can access resources and materials around human trafficking. We also will provide access to the materials that we do, which are really locally focused. And so we're happy to help you with that if you want that. How can you help victims to go back home? Flight ticket? We actually work with an organization called the International Organization for Migration, and they often do provide pay for tickets for people to go home. They also provide support services around reintegrating into their home community and make sure that there is support and a network of support for the victim. So, sorry, I'm running out of time, so I don't want to go too deep into that, but IOM is a great organization that does that type of work. The National Human Trafficking Resource Center is the 800 number that you'll often see on human trafficking materials, even in Washington State. We work very closely with them. So if they get a call from somebody who has someone who needs services and appears to be a victim of human trafficking, they will actually call us directly and patch that call through to us so that we can work directly with a local provider or a local potential victim. This is what I wanted to talk to you all about. If you work for an organization that provides case management already to victims, you could apply to become a subcontractor with the United States a Committee of Refugees and Immigrants. And they have a program that provides per capita services for survivors of human trafficking. This is a breakdown of the type of support that is provided under this program. And again, I'm happy for you to email me and I can connect you with USCRI. So that they can inform you at the process of applying to be a subcontractor with them. So I did not want to run out of time before I covered that. There is a way for your agency to receive reimbursement and financial support for clients. And yes, somebody just brought this up. This is only for foreign national victims or survivors, not U.S. citizens. This funding comes through the Department of Health and Human Services Office for Refugee Resettlement, and their focus is on serving foreign nationals, and we are happy to advise anyone in more detail about what that means. But there are also programs that serve U.S. citizens as well, so we can refer you to those programs wherever you happen to be. And just the pre-certified and certified, that has to do with whether or not a victim has received continued presence or a T visa, and I'm not going to go into the details of that, but we're happy to train people on that who are working with foreign national victims as appropriate. I promised we would put our information on here. Our website is warn-trafficking.org. Lots of information is on there. As I mentioned, we have a 24-hour victim assistance line. It's just a cell phone. It's not a staffed office with people waiting for the phone to ring. So really, we try to ask that only be used when a situation is urgent. Again, we're not first responders, but we will talk to people about options anytime when they need it. And then that is my email address and my office number. You can call those numbers to get in touch with me. Email's great. I always try to be responsive on there, so that would be a great way to get in touch with me. And I think that's it, unless there's more questions.
I think you caught all of them that came over the chat, so unless
Okay, good. You
can wait just a second if people have anything else that they want to throw in before we wrap up today.
Sorry I kind of rushed at the end there, everybody. That's sort of what happens.
We did check regarding the agreement of confidentiality. We do have some guidelines at WICSAP in just working with interpreters in general, but we do not have a model form for that. So if it's something that you have, Kathleen, that would be great. We can keep digging.
Sure.
But
yep, we can. I can try to dig a template up for you guys. And please, everybody, I think WICSAP's going to send out an evaluation. We love to hear feedback on our training. So if you have any feedback, we would really be appreciative of it.
Yes. So everyone, just remember to check your email and your spam folders. You should receive an email that has your training hours on it. It will have a link to that evaluation, and it will also have Kathleen's slides in there for your download. So that's an important email, so keep your eye out for it this afternoon.
And do you want me to switch to the wrap-up slide?
Yes.
Oh, that's what you're saying. Okay. Great.
Okay, well, it looks like people have gotten the information they need, so thank you so much, Kathleen, and thank you all for taking some time today to build your capacity in this area. So,
yeah, thanks, everybody. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Thank you. Please stand by.